to IRIS, your Iowa Radio Reading Service. This is the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Monday, July 25th. There's not a whole lot of local news, just a ragbri story in today's journal. So this may be a short reading. I'll begin with the weather. It says, for today, not as warm and breezy in the morning, a high of 76 for today. And for tonight, a low of 61 and mostly cloudy. For Tuesday, mostly cloudy with a stray thunderstorm, high of 83 and a low of 61. For Wednesday, some sun and nice, it says, showers in the evening, high of 85 and a low of 59. For Thursday, sunny much of the time and pleasant, high of 83 and a low of 54. Then for Friday, mostly sunny and nice, high of 84 and a low of 59. So just overall, it looks like highs in the 80s and lows in the low 60s or high 50s in the evenings. Much more like Iowa weather, I guess. Sunrise this morning was or will be at 6:11 a.m. Sunset will be at 8:53 p.m. For Tuesday, sunrise will be at 6:12 and sunset will be at 8:52. That front page ragbri story is headlined, First Stretch of the Ride, Riders Head to Ida Grove on Day 1 of 2022 Ragbri. Cyclists from around the world ventured out on the first day of Ragbri on Sunday, heading east from Sergeant Bluff at sunrise with their sights set on Ida Grove. The first day covered 53 miles of the 454 total miles. Riders were treated to fair weather with a high of 85 and light cloud cover. It's customary for riders to dip their rear tire in the water of the Missouri River on the first day and to dip their front tire in the Mississippi River once completing the ride. But because Sergeant Bluff is not next to the Missouri River, water from the river was transported to town so riders could dip their tires in it without having to bike additional miles. Early risers were treated to a fiery sunrise as they made their way from Sergeant Bluff, and locals sporting signs and whistles waved goodbye. The mass of over 20,000 riders quickly made it to Bronson, the first pass-through town of the trip, before making it to the day's meeting town, Anthon. In Anthon, riders were able to refill their water, mingle with each other, rest in the shade, and get food. Many opted for sweet corn, while others, like Piyush Patel, opted for loaded pulled pork nachos. Patel, who is from Dallas, said, "The first stretch of the ride was good and smooth." Patel then said, "This is the Texans' eighth ragbri, but first since 2019. There was also plenty of entertainment to keep riders' minds off their sore legs. Pictures with farm animals and chicken poop bingo were two popular choices." And there's a picture of some people playing chicken poop bingo. Mary Toff and Tina Derrick from Des Moines competed against each other in a tricycle race. The two enjoyed the ride from Sergeant Bluff. Derrick said, "It's been a lot of fun. We're getting there." Cyclists will be challenged with a 71-mile ride on Monday, the second longest day of the ride by mileage. The route will take them from Ida Grove to Pocahontas. More information can be found on the Ragbri website. Another front page story is headlined, Pope Visits Canada to Offer Apologies. This is bylined from Edmonton, Alberta. Pope Francis began a historic visit to Canada on Sunday to apologize to Indigenous peoples for abuses by missionaries at residential schools, a key step in the Catholic Church's efforts to reconcile with Native communities and help them heal from generations of trauma. Francis kissed the hand of a residential school survivor as he was greeted at the Edmonton, Alberta airport by Indigenous representatives, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, and Mary Simon, an Inuk, who is Canada's first Indigenous Governor General. The gesture set the tone of what Francis has said is a penitential pilgrimage to atone for the role of Catholic missionaries in the forced assimilation of generations of Native children a visit that has stirred mixed emotions across Canada as survivors and their families cope with the trauma of their losses and receive a long-sought papal apology. Francis had no official events scheduled Sunday, giving him time to rest before his meeting Monday with survivors near the site of a former residential school in Meskwakis, where he is expected to pray at a cemetery and apologize. Francis exited the back of his plane with the help of an ambulift, given his strained knee ligaments have forced him to use a wheelchair. The simple welcome ceremony took place in an airport hangar, where Indigenous drums and chanting broke the silence. As Trudeau and Simon sat beside Francis, a succession of Indigenous leaders and elders greeted the Pope and exchanged gifts. At one point, Francis kissed the hand of residential school survivor Elder Alma Disjarlis of the Frog Lake First Nations as she was introduced to him. "Right now, many of our people are skeptical and they are hurt," said Grand Chief George Arcand of the Confederacy of Treaty Six First Nations, who greeted the Pope. Yet he expressed hope that with the papal apologize, we could begin our journey of healing and change the way things have been for our people for many, many years. Indigenous groups are seeking more than just words, though, as they press for access to church archives to learn the fate of children who never returned home from the residential schools. They also want justice for the abusers, financial reparations, and the return of Indigenous artifacts held by the Vatican Museums. Assembly of First Nations National Chief Rose Ann Archibald, one of the country's most prominent Indigenous leaders, said several members of her family attended residential schools, including a sister who died at one in Ontario. She described it as an institution of assimilation and genocide. "During her flight to Alberta, I was just so overcome with emotion, and there were different times on the plane where I really had to stop myself from breaking into a deep sob," she said. "I realized that I am an intergenerational trauma survivor, and there are so many people like me." Francis's week-long trip, which will take him to Edmonton, Quebec City, and finally Iqaluit, Nunavut, in the far north, follows meetings he held in the spring at the Vatican with delegations from the First Nations, Métis, and Inuit. Those meetings culminated with a historic April 1st apology for the deplorable abuses committed by some Catholic missionaries in residential schools. Page 3 features a Bruce Miller review of Little Big Town that says Little Big Town offers up another great summer song. If you're looking for a lounging by the pool sipping song, check out All Summer. It's one of Little Big Town's cuts from the upcoming Mr. Sun album, and its perfect companion to Pontoon. Introduced at the group's Battery Park concert Saturday night, it has all the Lazy Days hallmarks you'd expect. The Four also offered up Hell Yeah, a bluesy Philip Sweet cut that had an odd Rocky Horror Show lips video with it, and Rich Man, a Jimmy Westbrook ballad that let him reflect on the kinds of things we may have taken for granted pre-pandemic. Karen Fairchild, Kimberly Schlappman, and Sweet added great harmonies, but this was one Westbrook will own. The second Battery Park concert had plenty of those hits to go around, yet Pontoon got it going, and a color-coded light show that matched each of the songs. Although there were several atmospheric videos that played on the big screens, they weren't necessary, particularly since it meant those in the back couldn't see the singers. "We're going to be having a party tonight, I can feel it," Fairchild said early on, and sure enough, even in the dark, they were ready for day drinking. They didn't skip the hits and were sure to give Better Man, a cut written by Taylor Swift, their own Swiftian spin. Newcomer Lindsay L. opened the show with her string of hits and covered The Chicks, I guess maybe the Dixie Chicks, yeah, Goodbye Earl, and did a quick homage to Bohemian Rhapsody. While What Happens in a Small Town gave Elle a number one hit, it had a different spin because she wasn't singing with Brantley Gilbert. She found a softer edge and got a chance to pump the emotion. L showed great guitar prowess on several songs, including I Don't Love You, which found her lying on the stage floor. The Canadian country singer had a lot of energy and a look that recalls Faith Hill and an ability to rouse the crowd. She also was good at detailing what the songs were about, which may have helped newcomers warm to her. She got the night going even though the concert was delayed more than 30 minutes. With weather threatening to stop things, it didn't. Elle handled damage control nicely, then cleared the way for the pontoon. A Sioux City favorite for years, Little Big Town has gone from opener to headliner with ease. The four are like old friends coming back for a summer visit. With those new cuts and their own wine label, they're the kind of visitors you want to make frequent stops. All summer, we're in. And that's Bruce Miller's review of Little Big Town. Jumping farther inside the newspaper to the Nation page, there's a story headlined, Monkeypox Virus Could Become Entrenched as New STD. This is byline from New York. The spread of monkeypox in the U.S. could represent the dawn of a new sexually transmitted disease, though some health officials say the virus that causes pimple-like bumps might yet be contained before it gets firmly established. Experts don't agree on the likely path of the disease, with some fearing that it is becoming so widespread that it is on the verge of becoming an entrenched STD like gonorrhea, herpes, and HIV. But no one's really sure, and some say testing and vaccines can still stop the outbreak from taking root. So far, more than 2,400 U.S. cases have been reported as part of an international outbreak that emerged 2 months ago. Health officials are not sure how fast the virus has spread. They have only limited information about people who have been diagnosed, and they don't know how many infected people might be spreading it unknowingly. They also don't know how well vaccines and treatments are working. One impediment? Federal health officials do not have the authority to collect and connect data on who has been infected and who has been vaccinated. With such huge question marks, predictions about how big the U.S. outbreak will get this summer vary widely, from 13,000 to perhaps more than 10 times that number. Dr. Rochelle Walensky, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, said the government's response is growing stronger every day and vaccine supplies will soon surge. Walensky said, I think we still have an opportunity to contain this. Monkeypox is endemic in parts of Africa where people have been infected through bites from rodents or small animals. It does not usually spread easily among people. But this year, more than 15,000 cases have been reported in countries that historically don't see the disease. In the U.S. and Europe, the vast majority of infections have happened in men who have sex with men, though health officials have stressed that anyone can catch the virus. It spreads mainly through skin-to-skin contact, but it can also be transmitted through linens used by someone with monkeypox. Although it's been moving through the population like a sexually transmitted disease, officials have been watching for other types of spread that could expand the outbreak. Symptoms include fever, body aches, chills, fatigue, and the bumps on parts of the body. The illness has been relatively mild in many men, and no one has died in the U.S., but people can be contagious for weeks, and the lesions can be extremely painful. When monkeypox emerged, there was reason to believe that public health officials could control it. The telltale bumps should have made infections easy to identify, and because the virus spreads through close personal contact, officials thought they could reliably trace its spread by interviewing infected people and asking who they had been intimate with. It didn't turn out to be that easy. With monkeypox so rare in the U.S., many infected men and their doctors may have attributed their rashes to some other cause. Contact tracing was often stymied by infected men who said they did not know the names of all the people they had sex with. Some reported having multiple sexual interactions with strangers. It didn't help that local health departments already burdened with COVID-19 and scores of other diseases now had to find the resources to do intensive contact tracing work on monkeypox. Indeed, some local health officials have given up expecting much from contact tracing. There was another reason to be optimistic. The U.S. government already had a vaccine. The two-dose regimen called Jynneos was licensed in the U.S. in 2019 and recommended last year as a tool against monkeypox. When the outbreak was first identified in May, U.S. officials had only about 2,000 doses available. The government distributed them but limited the shots to people who were identified through public health investigations as being recently exposed to the virus. Late last month, as more doses became available, the CDC began recommending the shots be offered to those who realize on their own that they could have been infected. Demand has exceeded supply, with clinics in some cities rapidly running out of vaccine doses and health officials across the country saying that they don't have enough. That's changing, Walensky said. As of this week, the government has distributed more than 191,000 doses, and it has 160,000 more ready to send. As many as 780,000 doses will become available as early as next week. Once current demand is satisfied, the government will look at expanding vaccination efforts. The CDC believes that 1.5 million U.S. men are considered at high risk for the infection. Testing has also expanded. More than 70,000 people can be tested each week, far more than current demand, Walensky said. The government has also embarked on a campaign to educate doctors and gay and bisexual men about the disease, she added. Donal Bisenzio, a researcher at RTI International, believes U.S. health officials will be able to contain the outbreak before it becomes endemic. But he also said that won't be the end of it. New bursts of cases will probably emerge as Americans become infected by people in other countries where monkeypox keeps circulating. Walensky agrees that such a scenario is likely. If it's not contained all over the world, we are always at risk of having flare-ups from travelers, she said. Sean Kiernan of the Fairfax County Health Department in Virginia said there is reason to be tentatively optimistic because so far the outbreak is concentrated in one group of people. Spread of the very virus into heterosexual people would be a tipping point that may occur before it's widely recognized, said Kiernan, chief of the department's communicable disease section. Next up is a weather-related story bylined from Promised Land, Pennsylvania. The headline says, 85 million under heat advisory. Officials warn of extremely oppressive conditions across the United States. It's not exactly flowing with milk and honey, but Promised Land offered respite Sunday for city folks in the Northeast trying to escape a nearly week-long hot spell that only threatened to intensify. Those with the resources fled to pools, beaches, and higher elevations like Promised Land State Park at 1,800 feet in Pennsylvania's Pocono Mountains in a drive of about 2.5 hours from New York City and Philadelphia. From the Pacific Northwest to southern Great Plains to the heavily populated Interstate 95 corridor, more than 85 million Americans were under excessive heat warnings or heat advisories issued by the National Weather Service. The agency warned of extremely oppressive conditions from Washington to Boston. Even in Promised Land, temperatures were forecast to soar above 90, but with shade from the forests, cool lake water, and mountain breezes, it was more than tolerable, visitors said. Rosa Chavez, 47, a high school teacher in Manhattan, applied sunscreen at a beach on Promised Land Lake. She and friend Arlene Rodriguez, who accompanied her, had just experienced Europe's own heat wave while vacationing last week in Florence, Italy. The heat is following us, said Rodriguez, 47, a real estate agent and property manager. Numerous record highs were expected to be tied or broken in the Northeast, the Weather Service said. Philadelphia was forecast to hit 100 degrees Sunday before even factoring in humidity. Newark, New Jersey, saw its fifth consecutive day of 100 degrees or higher, the longest such streak since records began in 1931. Boston also hit 100 degrees, surpassing the previous daily record high of 98 degrees set in 1933. At least two heat-related deaths have been reported in the Northeast, with officials warning of the potential for more. Philadelphia officials extended a heat emergency through Monday evening, sending workers to check on homeless people and knock on the doors of vulnerable residents. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu declared a heat emergency through Monday and kept a dozen cooling centers open. Athletic events were shortened or postponed. Organizers of the New York City Triathlon cut the distances that athletes had to run and bike. This weekend's Boston Triathlon was put off until August 20th. On the West Coast, forecasters warned of extreme heat arriving early this week and lingering until the weekend. Temperatures could break daily records in Seattle, Portland, and Northern California by Tuesday and climb to the highest level since a heat wave last year that killed hundreds of people across the Pacific Northwest. Many homes in the often rainy region lack air conditioning, and authorities caution that indoor heat is likely to build through the week, increasing the risk of heat-related illnesses, something emergency medical officials in Boston also warned of. Below that is a story headlined January 6th Panel Eyes Trump Cabinet. Cheney says committee also focused on Secret Service. The House January 6th committee said Sunday it will interview more former cabinet secretaries and is prepared to subpoena conservative activist Virginia Ginni Thomas, who's married to Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, as part of its investigation of the Capitol riot and Donald Trump's role. Lawmakers said they are deepening their inquiry after a series of 8 hearings in June and July, culminating in a primetime session Thursday, with plans to interview additional witnesses and reconvene in September to resume laying out their findings to the public. Representative Liz Cheney, the committee's vice chair, said, "We anticipate talking to additional members of the president's cabinet. We anticipate talking to additional members of his campaign. Certainly, we're very focused as well on the Secret Service." Cheney, a Republican from Wyoming, did not identify the Trump administration officials who might come forward, but the committee has previously made clear its interest in speaking with those believed to have considered invoking a constitutional process in the 25th Amendment to remove Trump from the office after the riot on January 6th, when hundreds of Trump supporters violently stormed the Capitol and interrupted the certification of Biden's election. The committee has aired testimony from former Attorney General William Barr, who said he told President Trump the claims were bull and had zero basis. In last week's hearing, the committee played testimony from then-Labor Secretary Eugene Scalia, who said he urged Trump to call a cabinet meeting to discuss an orderly transition of power. Other cabinet members have indicated they may have important details to share. Betsy DeVos, the education secretary at the time, previously told USA Today that she raised with Vice President Mike Pence the question of whether the cabinet should consider invoking the 25th Amendment, which would have required the vice president and the majority of the cabinet to agree that the president could no longer fulfill his duties. DeVos, in her resignation letter on January 7, 2021, blamed Trump for inciting the mob. "There is no mistaking the impact your rhetoric had on the situation, and it is the inflection point for me," she wrote. On the same day, Elaine Chao quit as transportation secretary. Chao, who was married to Senate GOP leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, said the attack had deeply troubled me in a way that I simply cannot set aside. Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State at the time, who was considering a 2024 presidential run, and Steve Mnuchin, Trump's Treasury Secretary, also were reported to have discussed the possibility of invoking the 25th Amendment, according to Jonathan Carl of ABC News in his book Betrayal. Representative Elaine Luria of Virginia, who is on the January 6th panel, said, "The floodgates have opened." Committee members also hope to learn more about Ginny Thomas's own effort to keep Trump in office and the potential conflicts of interest for Clarence Thomas as a result on January 6 cases that have come before the Supreme Court. The committee sent a letter to Ginny Thomas last month seeking an interview, Cheney said. And below that is a story from Jersey Dale, California, headlined Crews Protect Homes as Wildfire Burns Near Yosemite. A destructive wildfire near Yosemite National Park burned out of control through tinder dry forest on Sunday and had grown into one of California's biggest blazes of the year, forcing thousands of residents to flee remote mountain communities. Some 2,000 firefighters battled the Oak Fire, along with aircraft and bulldozers, facing tough conditions that includes steep terrain, sweltering temperatures, and low humidity, according to the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, or CAL FIRE. CAL FIRE spokesman Natasha Fouts said, "It's hot out there again today, and the fuel moisture levels are critically low." Crews on the ground protected homes as air tankers dropped retardant on 50-foot flames racing along ridgetops east of the tiny community of Jersey Dale. Light winds blew embers ahead into tree branches, and because it's so dry, it's easy for the spot fires to get established, and that's what fuels the growth, Fouts said. The fire erupted Friday southwest of the park near the town of Mid Pines in Mariposa County. Officials described explosive fire behavior on Saturday as flames made runs through bone-dry vegetation caused by the worst drought in decades. By Sunday, the blaze had consumed more than 22 square miles of forest land with no containment. The cause was under investigation. Evacuations were in place for over 6,000 people living across a several-mile span of the sparsely populated area in the Sierra Nevada foothills, though a handful of residents defied the orders and stayed behind, said Adrian Freeman with the U.S. Forest Service. "We urge people to evacuate when told," Friedman said. "This fire is moving very fast." And that brings me about halfway through the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Monday, July 25th. The journal is unusually short today, or brief today. There is only one more story on the Nation page before heading to sports. And that story is headlined, "Duluth Abortion Clinic Braces for Tide of Out-of-Staters." And this is bylined from Duluth, Minnesota. On the top floor of a modest two-story brick building near the shore of Lake Superior, the executive director of Northern Minnesota's only abortion clinic flits from room to room, checking on patients, fielding phone calls from people seeking appointments, and handling billing questions from those struggling to pay. In the waiting room at WE Health Clinic in Duluth, patients from Wisconsin and Texas sit among Minnesotans, the leading edge of an expected uptick in out-of-state patients following the Supreme Court's removal of the federal right to abortion. Lori Casey, the executive director, said, "It's just been really busy. We're trying to be as flexible as we can, especially with people coming from out-of-state. A lot of our patients, even if they're from Minnesota, travel 1 to 3 hours each way to get here, so we try to be as accommodating as we can." Even before Roe v. Wade was reversed, WE Health Clinic was the nearest abortion provider for some people in northern Wisconsin, northern Minnesota, and Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Today, the clinic's employees are acutely aware of their state's status as an island for legal abortion in the Upper Midwest. Abortion is now illegal or treated as such in Wisconsin and South Dakota. North Dakota is expected to follow suit in late July, and Iowa's Republican governor asked the state courts to severely limit the procedure. The clinic raised its cap on patients from 16 to 20 on the one day a week when abortions are typically performed. Its staff try to schedule abortions on other days when necessary, and many set aside an additional half or full day each week for abortion services. Dr. Judith Johnson, one of three doctors providing abortions at the clinic, said, "We haven't overcome overcome our capacity to serve patients yet, and we are working on efficiencies so that we're ready if we do end up with a flood of patients. Johnson said the increased pressure began months before the Supreme Court decision, with inquiries from people in Texas and Oklahoma as those states introduced highly restrictive abortion bans. The extra patient load at WE Health Clinic includes people who struggled to get speedy appointments at some Minneapolis area clinics, where five of the state's seven abortion clinics are located following the Supreme Court's decision. The seventh clinic is in Rochester. Johnson said, the number of patients we serve has gone up, and the places they come from have gotten further away. The clinic isn't able to help everyone who calls. Cassidy Thompson, a patient educator and coordinator of the clinic's volunteer patient escort program, recounted a call from a woman in Oklahoma who was crying to me on the phone saying, can't you help me? No other clinics can take me right now. That patient was hoping for a telehealth consultation that would allow her to stay in Oklahoma and still obtain a medication abortion from the clinic. However, state law requires patients to have a Minnesota mailing address and to be physically in Minnesota when speaking with a doctor. Thompson said, the entire purpose of my career is to provide abortion care and to tell someone we legitimately cannot help them with anything and they are stuck with a forced pregnancy is just a complete takeaway of power. Most of the Minnesota patients at the clinic qualify for low-income assistance to help with the cost of an abortion, but it doesn't cover the full cost of the procedure. Casey estimated that the clinic lost more than $60,000 last year by serving medical assistance patients, a deficit the clinic had to make up through fundraising. Paulina Briggs, the lab supervisor and a patient educator at the clinic, said, a lot of doctors' offices put caps on how many medical assistance patients they might see, but we don't do that because we really want to provide for people that need it the most. Out-of-state patients don't qualify for Minnesota's medical assistance program, nor does the clinic help out-of-state patients with travel costs. It doesn't have the resources, Casey said. All of this contributes to financial strain for people traveling across state lines for abortion care. Briggs said, it's just really sad to think about those people. Where they live is going to determine the kind of care that they're going to get, and the people that are most in need of services are going to have the hardest time accessing it. Briggs said phones have been crazy, with calls from people, including nurses, physicians' assistants, and attorneys, wanting to volunteer, help, or donate to the clinic, which also offers a range of non-abortion services such as birth control and breast and cervical cancer screenings. Casey said, the major challenge right now is just financial stability, making sure we have the financial resources to keep our clinic up and running. It's just really sad that when I started here in 1981, we didn't have that many restrictive laws, and now we've just gone backwards. That is the end of news stories, so I'm going to read a couple of sports stories and then Dear Abby, and that will be it for today. The first sports story is headlined, Mobile Legion Baseball Wins State Title in Spencer. After taking down the Iowa Great Lakes Okoboji's Milford Post 384 by a score of 5-4 in the opening round, the Mobile Futures of Wink Sparks Mobile Post 303 defeated Woodbury County 5-4 in the Iowa American Legion State Baseball Tournament. The Mobile Futures were led by Caleb Bleal of Woodbury Central. Bleal is committed to Morningside for his college ball. Bleal went 2-for-4 with one RBI and one run scored in the opening round game against Iowa Great Lakes. Helan's Ian Gill, who plays for Woodbury County of George Nelson Legion Post 662, went 4-for-5 with four doubles and four RBIs in its semifinal game against the Hiawatha Warriors of Hiawatha Post 735. Woodbury County won its semifinal game 12-6. The championship game was set as Mobile and Woodbury County squared off for a trip to the American Legion regional playoffs in Rapid City. Bleel was the starting pitcher for Mobile, who held a 4-1 lead in the top of the seventh inning. Gill, carrying the momentum from his semifinal performance earlier in the afternoon, hit a 360-foot three-run home run to tie the game. In the bottom of the inning, Sergeant Bluff Luton's Bryce Click, playing for Mobile and committed to play college baseball at Northwestern, hit a single up the middle to score Damon Schmid of Kingsley Pearson, winning the game. Schmidt is committed to play at Iowa Central Community College. Bleel won tournament MVP for his performance in both games Sunday. The other sports story of interest, I guess, to Iowa is headlined Newgarden Taken to Hospital, O'Ward Wins at Iowa. And this is byline from Newton. Joseph Newgarden collapsed in the motorhome lot following his late crash Sunday at Iowa Speedway and was taken to a Des Moines hospital by helicopter for evaluation. IndyCar medical director Dr. Jeffrey Billows said Newgarden was being transported by helicopter to Mercy One in Des Moines because the infield care center lacked the equipment to properly evaluate the Team Penske driver who cut open the back of his head when he collapsed. Billows said Newgarden was awake and alert, but the hospital was a 45-minute drive from the track, and heavy traffic for the post-race Blake Shelton concert would have delayed the journey. Newgarden dominated and led 148 of the 300 laps while trying to sweep the weekend, but something on his Team Penske car broke with 64 laps remaining, and he spun hard into the outside wall, creating an opening for Patty O'Ward of Arrow McLaren SP to win the race. Newgarden was visibly rattled after his mandatory check in the infield care center after the crash. Newgarden said, "Definitely was a bit of a shot. I want to cry. So sad for my team. I don't know what happened. Everything felt fine to me. Totally unexpected, and it caught me by surprise. Team Penske is the best. I never have this stuff, so maybe we were due. We can't afford it for this year, but we'll fight back. We have a great team here," Newgarden said. Chevrolet's initial diagnosis was the suspension broke on Newgarden's car. There was no immediate word on the force in which Newgarden hit the outside wall. Billows said Newgarden cleared all tests in the care center after the crash, but IndyCar had planned to reevaluate him Thursday in Indianapolis before he collapsed upon returning to the motorhome lot. O'Ward made the pass for the win on pit road with a speedy stop by his Arrow McLaren SP team and held off Penske teammates Will Power and Scott McLaughlin for the win. It's the second win of the season for the Mexican driver, who finished second on Saturday and remains firmly in the IndyCar title race with five races remaining. O'Ward is fifth in the standings, 36 points behind leader Marcus Ericsson. His win halted Team Penske's dominance on the 0.894-mile oval, where Roger Penske's drivers had won six of the last seven races prior to Sunday. Scott Dixon of Chip Ganassi Racing finished fourth and was followed by teammate Jimmy Johnson, who raced hard with Indianapolis 500 winner Ericsson to earn his best finish through two seasons of IndyCar racing. Ericsson is also a Ganassi driver, and Newgarden's crash helped the Swede retain the lead in the IndyCar standings, making Johnson's aggressive racing a bit nerve-wracking for the Ganassi camp. Johnson said, "I race my teammates with the most respect I possibly can every race I've been in. I've given way. That was really the first time I fought for position and felt like I should have been up there passing Dixon. Today I had it in me and I raced clean, hard, and just had an awesome day." Ericsson said Johnson's experience on ovals was the difference. The seven-time NASCAR champion made 686 starts in a stock car and won 83 races. Ericsson said, "Yeah, you know, he has a couple of more oval races than me under his belt. I think that's what I was thinking when he was battling me. All the time I was trying to start to sort of make him go in my dirty air. Every time I looked in my mirror, he was inside out. Oh my God, step behind me, please." It was another podium sweep for Chevrolet, who did it on Saturday with Newgarden, O'Ward, and Power. Newgarden was second as the points leader at the time of his crash and dropped to a tie with Dixon for third in the standings following his crash. There are five drivers separated by 36 points in the standings, and Erickson leads Power by 8 points. Dear Abby, we'll conclude today's reading. The headline is, After Decades of Being Alone, Woman Ponders Purpose in Life. Dear Abby, I am 66 and a 20-year widow. I live alone but have an active social life with my woman friends. We live in a small town with very little to do, but we get together often to watch movies, eat out, etc. I never had children, and all my relatives have passed away. I'm the last family member left. I'm mostly satisfied, but not happy, with my life. Everything I own is paid for, and I have enough money to last until my death. I have everything, materially, I could possibly want or need, yet I feel something vital is missing from my life. It's not religion. I am a committed Christian. I could pay cash for anything I want, but I don't want for anything. I do volunteer work, am socially active and involved in my church, yet I feel empty inside. Something is definitely missing, and I can't figure it out. I realize I'm blessed, and most people would give anything to sit where I'm sitting. Do you have any ideas as to what's missing or where to go from here? Life is hard, and old age isn't for sissies. Signed, Living Life in Texas. And Abby responds, You may be experiencing something people call an existential crisis, which is not uncommon. It refers to someone who wonders if his or her life has meaning or purpose. Rather than dwell on what may be missing from your life, perhaps consider spending some time reflecting on some of the positive differences you make in the lives of others. When was the last time you helped someone feel better about herself? Have you gone out of your way to do a friend or an acquaintance a favor, or lent a willing ear to someone who's needed to talk? If the answer is yes, start a journal. Write your thoughts and activities down and review it when you feel empty. If you do it for a while, it may give you a different perspective. Discuss your feelings with your friends, some of whom have likely experienced something similar, and make 30 minutes of exercise a part of your daily routine. Exposure to sunlight can lift your mood, but if that doesn't help, schedule an appointment with your doctor to make sure everything is in order emotionally and physically. The second letter begins, Dear Abby, whether my siblings were right, wrong, or indifferent, my mom always stood up for them. Even when she knew they lied, she would look at me and say, I have to believe them, they are my daughters. When I would ask her, What am I? She would restate her last comment. Not surprisingly, my mother and I don't see eye to eye on anything, and I would never feel comfortable going to her for help or advice. She has paid for all my sister's court costs. When I needed help as a student teacher, she told me I would figure it out. I always did, but I can never understand why she truly didn't like me. I guess I'm asking when I should just walk away. Signed, Ready to Call It Quits. And Abby responds, Dear Reddy, your mother's blatant favoritism was shameful. To stick around attempting to ingratiate yourself to someone who will never give you love or respect you deserve would be a waste of time. When should you walk away? You have my blessing to start today. I know you will find it therapeutic. And that ends the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Monday, July 25th. You can access this recording and others at the Iris Radio Reading website, iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening.
This is Tom Hatton with an Irish short take from the book A Culinary History of Iowa. Article we're reading now is entitled Manna Colonies Maintain Rich History in Iowa. The Icarians weren't the only communal society to play a role in Iowa's culinary history. The famous Manna Colonies in eastern Iowa were also founded on communal principles, but unlike the Icarians, the Mannas had a strong religious component. By the 1700s, people across northern Europe had become dissatisfied with the rituals and intellectualism of the Lutheran Church and had begun to rebel and separate from the Church. Adherents to a new faith called the Community of True Inspiration formed their own self-reliant communities. Known as the Inspirationists, these men and women and their families found refuge in central Germany. Persecution and an economic depression in Germany in the 1830s, however, forced the community to search for a new home. Hundreds of Inspirationists immigrated to America in 1843-44 in search of religious freedom. They pooled their resources and established a community named Ebenezer near modern-day Buffalo, New York. All property was held in common. Farms and factories were established, and the community of nearly 1,200 people prospered. When more farmland was needed for the growing community, the Inspirationists looked to Iowa, where attractively priced land was available. A committee was sent to inspect land in Iowa in the mid-1850s. The Iowa River Valley proved particularly promising. Here, the men found acres of rich soil, good timber, water, limestone, sandstone, and clay necessary for establishing a new community. The leaders chose the name Amana, meaning remain true, from Song of Solomon 4:8. Starting in 1855, six villages were established a mile or two apart, including Amana, East Amana, West Amana, South Amana, High Amana, and Middle Amana. The village of Homestead was added in 1861, giving the Amana colonies access to the railroad. Each village had its own school, farm, and craft industries to make it virtually self-sufficient. The communal way of life was continued in Amana, much like it had been in Ebenezer. All property was held in common. Families were assigned housing in buildings owned by the Amana Society. Each individual worked at a designated job. Religious life was the strong unifying factor. In the seven villages, residents received a home, medical care, meals, all household necessities, and schooling for their children. Property and resources were shared. Men and women were assigned jobs by the village council of brethren. No one received a wage. Farming and the production of wool and calico supported the community. But village enterprises, from clockmaking to brewing, were vital. Well-crafted products became a hallmark of the Amana colonies, which are still known for exceptional wines and more. People were called to work before dawn by the gentle tolling of the bell in the village tower in Old Amana, where the pace of life was much different than today. More than 50 communal kitchens provided three daily meals, as well as mid-morning and mid-afternoon snacks to all colonists. These kitchens were operated by the women of the Amana colonies and were well supplied by the village smokehouse, bakery, ice house, and dairy, as well as the orchards, vineyards, and huge communal gardens maintained by the villagers. During the growing season, there was plenty of work to do in the gardens and kitchens, from planting and harvesting to preparing and storing vegetables, from cabbage to turnips. Around 1900, for example, it wasn't unusual for the communal kitchens in just one Amana village to produce more than 400 gallons of sauerkraut. It took a lot of food and labor to sustain the villages within the Amana colonies. Children attended school 6 days a week, year-round, until age 14. Boys were then assigned jobs on the farm or in the craft shops, while girls were assigned to a communal kitchen or garden. Work and faith were often intertwined and were intertwined in the villages, where the Inspirationists attended worship services 11 times per week. Times were changing by the early 20th century, however. Improved communications and transportation in the 1920s began to exert their influence on the Amana colonies. In addition, the collapse of the American economy following the stock market crash of October 1929 left no aspect of daily life untouched. The Great Depression and disastrous farm economy made the isolated communal life in Amana socially and economically impossible. In the early 1930s, Amana set aside its communal way of life. A strong desire on the part of the residents to maintain their community finally propelled the change, according to Amana history shared by the Amana Colonies Convention and Visitors Bureau. By 1932, the communal way of life was seen as a barrier to achieving individual goals. Rather than leave or watch their children leave the community, the people of the Amana villages changed. Members voted to abandon the communal system and established the Amana Society Incorporated, a profit-sharing corporation to manage the farmland, mills, and larger enterprises. Private enterprise was encouraged. While this separated the economic aspect of the community from the church, the Amana Church Society continued to be the religious foundation of the community. Today, the seven villages of the Amana colonies are among the state's most popular tourist attractions. Declared a National Historic Landmark in 1965, the Amana colonies attract hundreds of thousands of visitors annually who come to experience a place where the past is cherished and hospitality is a way of life. The streets of the Amana colonies, lined with their historic brick, stone, and clapboard houses, their flower and vegetable gardens, and their lanterns and walkways, recall the Amana of yesterday. Many museums are available for tours, including the communal kitchen in Middle Amana, preserved just as it was on the day in 1932 when the last communal meal was served in the colony. The communal kitchen lets you step back in time. Guides explain kitchen routines and share insights on communal life. Guests can also enjoy a satisfying taste of Amana history and hospitality at the famous Ox Yoke Inn, a full-service restaurant founded in 1940 in the village of Amana. The Ox Yoke Inn's nationally recognized reputation of fresh, quality food served family style reflects the restaurant's old-world signature dishes. The Ox Yoke Inn serves traditional German and American favorites at breakfast, lunch, and dinner, as well as on Sunday brunch buffet. Glimpses of the past are also preserved in some of the gardens in the Amana colonies. With the passing of the old order in 1932, the number of the society's large vegetable gardens and orchards dwindled, but Larry Reddick and his wife Wilma still grow some of the colony's heirloom varieties in their fourth-generation South Amana vegetable garden. In 1980, they founded a seed bank to preserve heirloom plants for the future generations. In his 2013 book, Gardening the Amana Way, Reddick's chapters on modern vegetable and flower gardening in today's Amana colonies showcase his cottage in the meadow gardens, now listed with the Smithsonian's Archives of American Gardens. Old intermingles with new across Reddick's gardens as heirloom lettuce keeps company with the latest cucumber variety. It's a living tribute to the unique history of Amana colonies and one of America's longest-lived communal societies. And that was an excerpt from a culinary history of Iowa by Darcy Doherty, Malsey, and other offbeat stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.